Wednesday, January 26th. What is happening to my vaunted energy? I am no longer rampant to get up and go to work, and I slept until nearly 10. There's a particular pleasure in having house guests in the White House because you think it means so much to them. It's nice to have Eloise and Homer here. I'd ask some of Eloise's special friends, Scooter Miller and Ann Worley, and Madeline Grant, Millie Hudson, Elizabeth Hutchinson, Andre Lindo, and Zenda Pipkin, to come over and have coffee with us in the morning. We sat in the yellow room and discussed all sort of feminine chatter. Most of us old friends from Texas, as with Scooter or Ann Worley, or Liz or Zenda, are from the 75th Club, as with Maddie Lee. And Andre is almost a godmother to Lucy, who came bounding in to hug those she loved. It's between terms, and she's making the most of it. It was a morning of that particular comfort of being with old friends. Natalie's daughter's going to be cherry blossom princess for Alabama. Jean Worley, after surgery in a very bad time, is going to be finally able to eat barbecue in the backyard once more and have us all over. And Millie Hudson is going through that cruelly lonely time of being a new widow. When they left, I worked on my clothes for the New York trip. And then when Lyndon came in, with Secretary Rusk and Admiral Rabun and Mac George Ball and Jack, he asked me to have a bite of lunch with them. George Ball told a delightful story about Harriman, which is characteristic of the way that he has behaved as a public servant, especially in the last years of his life, when apparently any dream he may have had of being president has dissipated, and certainly without any bitterness on his part. It seemed that President Kennedy had called Harriman up while he was overseas and asked him to take a job in the State Department. They talked, and Harriman agreed. Later on, he said to George, "The connection was not very good. Did he say Undersecretary of European Affairs or Far Eastern Affairs?" "That's him. He'll tackle the job." Dean Rusk said that Harriman's willingness to serve in a post that wasn't, after all, exactly the top echelon, and he a man of such caliber, it meant a lot to the morale of the State Department. The conversation got around to the great quantity of senators who had gone to Vietnam when Congress was out of session. Lyndon was particularly uncomfortable about having Teddy Kennedy go. Rusk had told him that he absolutely must take all safety precautions he was asked to, and nevertheless he had gone in helicopters on places where it was perhaps wisest not to. Lyndon said, "We just couldn't afford another tragedy in the Kennedy family." And Rusk used an expression that somehow laid a man's value on the line in a rather fearsome way. He was loath but would be finally willing to let any of the politicians go who were constitutionally expendable. That means that the president or the vice president or anybody in the direct line of succession, he would bar from going if he could, or so it sounded to me. Then there was a time to sign mail, and shortly after 4, I had tea with Andre Meyer, who has given the Mary Cassatt to the White House, and who, with Mary Lasker, is donating the cherry trees for the magnificent project of Haynes Point. But all of this is anonymous, and it was just my great hope in this hour to explore him and to let him know how much it meant, this house and those who would live in it, and to all the thousands of tourists and Washingtonians who will drive around Haynes Point. Think what the tidal basin has meant to this town. It's practically everybody's first mental picture of Washington. Cherry trees and water and monuments. And it began with the gift of the cherry trees by the Japanese government in 1912. It proved a fascinating hour for me. An international financier, Frenchman with a heavy accent. He lives his life mostly in New York, but also in Paris and London. He's Mary Lasker's great friend and financial advisor, and a gentle, generous, rather sentimental human being. He's been coming to this house during the administrations of 4 presidents quite a few times under Roosevelt, he told me, when he was able to be of some service to the president in international financial matters, and also during Truman's time here. And then, with the slightest change in inflection in the voice, he did not come much during the Eisenhower times. I'm not sure whether he said not at all. And then another noticeable change, quite frequently during the time when Kennedy was president. He was one of 12 people to be denationalized, along with de Gaulle, when the Vichy government was in power in France, but he's been a United States citizen for a long time. I asked him who he knew in the cabinet, and it turned out that Trudy Fowler was his very special friend, and for a delightful reason. He'd been having a late business conference with Joe. Joe'd asked him to go home with him. Trudy had cooked the dinner, and this he found a very pleasing thing, because, he said, of my humble origins. So I called Bess and asked her to seat him between Trudy and Eloise. Did a little more phoning later on to get special cabinet friends to take care of guests whom I thought might be lonesome. And then it was time for the big event of the day, the dinner in honor of the Vice President and the Chief Justice. But first, there was a moment of posing in front of America Sat, an article in Red Book, a long picture session by some very avant-garde bearded photographers who turned out to be just like the rest of us in that they wanted autographs for their nieces and nephews. And then it was time to go into the yellow oval room to meet our upstairs guest. I had called back a couple of times to make sure that Hubert and Muriel had put any of their children on the list who might enjoy coming. And I was particularly glad that their Nancy and her husband did come. And the Chief Justice's family was there in full number. The John Daly's, the James Warrens. I believe either they or it could have been their young son who had been so particularly nice to our children. And the Young Republicans for Johnson meetings in California. And Carmen Warren Clemente. We had a nice family time upstairs in the yellow room. And then the colors preceded us downstairs, and to the glorious strains of Hail to the Chief, we marched down. The pictures made at the bottom of the stairs. I was in my yellow dress, and they were good enough. But much the most dramatic picture were the Humphreys arriving in the snowstorm out front. And what a storm it was, adding a certain zest to the evening. And then the sense of drama as we marched into the East Room. How many times will we do it without that quickening of the pulse? All of the justices were there, and all of the members of the cabinet, except Stuart, who was out of town making a speech, but Lee gaily substituting for both of them, even though the speaker was absent because of his brother's death, and he's in mourning. It was a good representation from his side, and it was particularly delightful to see Catherine Long with Russell. To Senator Saltonstall, I had a moment to say that it was with a pang that I had read that he was going to retire. There were the Everett Dirksons, like characters out of a play. Shakespearean one. I was very sorry that the Smathers and the Keekles were not there. Some of the youngest and most attractive ones. But most of the other leadership was. Mansfields and the Arryns and the Boggs and the Alberts and the Fords and the Mosses. And Admiral Rayburn, who has the most thankless job in town. And that most unparty-goer, J. Edgar Hoover. I was glad to have put on the list myself the new appointee, the Solicitor General Thurgood Marshall. Among Texans, the Bill Bowers were there, Aaron Farfolds of Houston, the John Hills of Cypress Mills. Turned out, Mr. Hill, to be almost 7 feet tall, and of course Eloise, whom I had tuned in to take care of several guests. And from the world of arts, the Felix de Weldons, who'd done a medallion for the inaugural. And Alan J. Lerner, of My Fair Lady and Brigadoon, and more hits than I can name, and handsome Hugh O'Brien, when I danced with him later. It was one of the high points of the evening for me. From the world of education, Dr. Lee DuBridge, president of California Institute of Technology at Pasadena, and a very attractive couple, Dr. and Mrs. James Hester, president of New York University. And there were old friends there, the Willie Hopkins. I've been waiting for a chance to have them to a dinner. And lots of staff, many of whom I've been able to ask at the last minute because of the snow, the Califanos, the Hornigs, the Bill Crocketts of the State Department. Dr. Wayne Grover, with whom I worked on the library. At my table, I had the Vice President on my right, always ensuring a delightful evening, and the Chief Justice, the kindliest, most solid of gentlemen. I ever wound up the billboards demanding his impeachment. It's one of the peculiarities of this age. But Dr. Howard Mitchell, by all odds, was the gayest member of our table, full of stories of the world of music, and of grandfather. He's just become the grandfather of twins, weighing 9 pounds 3 ounces and 8 pounds 5 ounces. His son married Sylvia, the daughter of the Austrian ambassador. Bibby Cater, Mike Mansfield, very silent, Elizabeth Black, always sweet and contributing, smooth, attractive Mrs. Hester, and Mr. Justice White composed our table. I wonder if everybody looked at the food as it came by with the same eagle eye I did. All this foolishness about Renee leaving and us borrowing a chef. But it turned out to be a delicious dinner. The main course named Filet of Beef Waverly, after Hubert's home. And the dessert, Strawberries Nana, after Mrs. Warren. And then a toast from Lyndon in the state dining room, which made me realize that we had to get cued in better on the technological device of such things, because after all, this is a house and not a stage. We only began hearing him on the second paragraph. It's always comfortable and reassuring and happy to sit by Hewitt. What a good quality. And the presence of the Chief Justice always makes me think. This republic with its dual party system is a pretty durable, solid place. So I enjoyed my evening, though I wouldn't name it one of those that glittered and glowed. Then, after coffee and brandies, we went in to hear Tammy Grimes sing songs from the unsinkable Molly Brown. A good friend of ours had said that Lucy reminded her of Tammy Grimes in that play. I'd ask Lucy to stop in and meet us in the yellow room or to show up for the entertainment. She didn't. Later on, I heard she'd stroll through the halls in an orange sweater and slacks with a pail full of fried chicken from some hot shop place, which she had dispensed to all the guards outside in the snow who'd wanted some. She has a talent for leading her individual life. It wasn't long after the entertainment when Lyndon left, which of course was duly noted, especially by Maxine Cheshire next day, who said, "Guests came late and some VIPs left early." I remember all the days of the Eisenhower administration, when Lyndon and the Speaker pulled me protesting from the state dining room to the car without seeing the entertainment, and I knew that there was at least one woman who would understand that Lyndon was not really a candidate for a higher office, and that was Miss McCafferty, the social secretary. I stayed to dance and talk. The victory cell, the blind columnists, for the Texans, especially Alice and Willie, and to listen to Hugh O'Brien's poignant recital, taking the tapes in the hospital in Vietnam from the wounded soldiers, keeping the party going as best my presence could. After Lyndon left, the snowstorm continued and lent its added measure of coziness and threat. And then, a little after 12, I, too, left for upstairs while the music slowed and the guests departed.